This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
What we're going to look at today is not directly connected to the Holocaust, but is connected to how rabbinic text or how Midrash responds to the idea of suffering without cause. In other words, this idea that people experience tragedy in their lives and that there's no one to blame. There's no obvious cause. These are not wicked people. These are righteous people. Occupies the rabbis for obvious reasons. First of all, because it's the normal, you know, experience of being human. But in addition, because post-Second Temple, they've had several hundred years to reflect on why the destruction has happened, why the exile has happened to God's people. It can't be that everyone is sinners. It can't be that everyone who was killed, tortured, sent into exile, sin. And how do you deal with theodicy, essentially? But they're not going to be, they're going to use the biblical text, particularly the deaths of Nadav and Avihu, to examine this idea of how do we respond to suffering in the world without due cause? How do we understand to some degree the ways of God? But beyond the ways of God, how are we meant to respond as people to, you know, kind of the unfairness of the death of innocence? Okay, so let's take a look at chapter 10. We're going to chapter 10, and then we're going to look at chapter 16. Very quickly, I'm not spending, it's not a Tanakh class. What happens with the death, there are a few things I want to point out, though, in chapter 10 that the Midrashic author picks up on, and there's one in particular that does a fantastic wordplay, as we'll see, or fantastic word reference. If we take a look at chapter 10, Vayikhu b'nei Aaron Nadav v'Avihu ish machtato, v'yinu bahen esh v'yasimu alei ktoret v'yikrevu lifnei Adonai esh zara asher lo tziva otam. We have the sons of Aaron, and Igor has already heard this this morning, but with your permission, I'll just review, that Aaron's sons, Nadav and Avihu, the attendants of Aaron, who have been serving him for 7 days and now the eighth day faithfully, in the wake of God's appearance, or God's fire coming down into the camp and consuming the burnt offering and the fat parts on the altar, Nadav and Avihu take their fire pans, put fire in it, put incense in it, and offered it before the Lord. And we're told this is an alien fire, Esh Zara Asher Lo Tzuva Otam, an alien fire which he had not enjoined upon them. And then fire comes forth from the Lord and consumes them, and thus they died, and we're told V'yamutu Lifnei Adonai. Now these two verses occupy rabbinic commentary, medieval commentary, modern commentary. Did they sin? Didn't they sin? Did they get in the way of the divine fire? Did they got too close to the divine fire? Meaning, there's not clear understanding of why what they did warrants such an extreme response from God. Okay, and so here are two holy men, two righteous men engaged in God's work, who deviate from God's direct command, but not in a sinful way, not in an obviously sinful way, not in a transgressive way, but nonetheless are consumed before God, Vayamutu Lifnei Adonai. And we understand there's terrible tragedy there, and if we had time, we'd talk a lot about Aaron's response, which is absolute silence, Vayidom Aharon. One of the things I talked about 1 year on Tisha B'Av, I remember you were there, but it was many years ago, is that the initial rabbinic response to the destruction is silence. Mm-hmm. Meaning if you look in the Tanaitic texts, there's almost no response to the destruction. They are building. They are creating. They are creating a rabbinic world, a halachic world. It's only when we get to the Amoraim, to 4-500 CE in Eretz Yisrael, that they begin to look at, using largely Eicha, but also here we're seeing it, this idea of theodicy. And so silence is also the rabbinic response initially to the enormous destruction of the Jewish people and their temple. And so Aaron serves as a paradigm for the idea that sometimes words just don't come. We can't articulate the pain that we feel in the wake of tremendous suffering. And then Moshe goes further. He tells them, not only can't you express yourself, you can't tear your hair, you can't dishevel your hair, you can't tear your clothing. God's presence is still very much in the camp. I want to turn to the end of chapter 10, verse 16. Basically, Moses gets angry. He asks about the goat of the sin offering, and it has been burnt. And what really was supposed to happen is they were supposed to sit down and consume, the priests, in a festive meal, the sacrifices. It's supposed to be a party. God has appeared. God's presence has given benediction or consecration to the tabernacle. And Moses is a letter of the law kind of guide. And despite the tragedy, and it's interesting to think about what Moses thinks about death. Is Moses at a level where death already doesn't threaten Moses? He's so close to God that maybe he doesn't see the difference between life and death. I don't know. It's an interesting question. Where is Moses in this? But Moses' response to Aaron's sons is anger. How could you not have done what you're supposed to? Why did you not eat the sin offering? Lama lo achaltem? And Aaron then, and my husband pointed out, he read something in one of the weekly Parsha newsletters, this is the first machloket we have, the first difference of opinion, where Moses states the law and Aaron questions. And what's beautiful here is no one involves God. Lo bashamayim hi. And I think that's very powerful because sometimes, again, we have to use intuition, common sense, human ability to think things through. Moses, the letter of the law guy, says, why aren't you eating your kudshim? And Aaron then, in a very, I think it's a very adin way, a gentle way, says, Hayitav be'inei Adonai. Is this what God would want? This is what God would want for me to sit down and eat, to pretend this day is like no other? I followed the letter of the law, Moses. We didn't deviate from the protocol, not for a second. We went through the motions. We did everything we were supposed to. But sitting down to eat is more than protocol. It's asking us to engage in some sort of festivity, some sort of happiness. Is this what God wants? And what does Moses do? The answer here is also, Vayishma Moshe, Moshe heard, which is often what we need when we disagree with one another. Again, I'm sure Daniel talks about this in his conflict resolution, because I know he researched it. He wrote his thesis on Aaron. But this Vayishma Moshe, Moshe listens, Vayitav Be'inav. And I'll just say the Vayitav Be'inav is unclear. I know the JPS says he approved with the lowercase h. I wonder if we could argue that God approved. Moses hears and God approves. Could be Moses hears and Moses approves. That's the obvious reading. But when there's an elusive pronoun. Sometimes the Midrash will suggest sometimes Moses, sometimes God, because Moses and God are so tightly connected. And so something very powerful just went on, a shift, and Aaron teaches Moses something. This is not the time for festivity, despite God's presence. We have to mourn our dead. Okay. And the verse I want to jump to right now, because this is, what I want to call your attention to, and that I think the Midrash is going to play on, is the words yitav, or heitiv. This idea of, will it be good for God? And it was good in Moses' eyes. I'm going to come back to that word tov. It's going to appear in the Midrash. Chapter 16, just very quickly to look at the first verses that the Midrash, that this is going to take us to the Midrash. This is what we're interested in. What happened to my Vayikra-Rabba? Okay, one second. I'm in chapter 16 of Leviticus. We're skipping forward. So now, five chapters later, God speaks, the Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron who died. When they drew too close to the presence of the Lord, v'yamutu. And then the Lord says to Moses. So now in chapter 20 of Vayikra Rabbah, I'm going to bring you just a few of the voices that appear in this chapter. I think there are 12 or 13 drashot here. One of the things that I remind my students is Midrash is not uniform. There is no one voice. The Midrash says is not God speaking from Sinai. It's human interpretation, rabbinic interpretation, and it doesn't have to agree one with the other. There does not have to be uniformity. What we're getting is one verse and 13 different expressions of interpretation. And we're going to go from the beginning of the chapter. Again, the editor has clearly collated and organized the voices, so we're moving in a certain direction. And I'm just going to give you a few of the voices to give a sense of the sweep of the interpretation. Okay. Pretty short. Did I not have my Yikra Rabba here? Hold on, I thought I had brought in... I have brought in a blue book. I must have left it.
I remember you putting it on the table.
Yeah, I put it on the table. Yeah. Okay, well, we will make do.
Do you want us to go get it?
No, it's okay. It's going to be fine with that. Don't worry. Okay, after the death of the two sons of Aaron, Rabbi Levi opened his discourse by saying, and here I'm going to quote the verse in Hebrew, Amarti lahulalim al taholalu. This is a verse from Tehillim. This is very classic of the Rabbah Midrash, the early Rabbah Midrash, that you start with a verse that is not in the Pasuk, and you actually pique the interest or the curiosity of the audience. Remember, it's a very oral tradition. People presumably knew Tanakh by heart. And you would start off with a verse, you're talking about the Parasha, but you go to Tehillim or to Iyov or to Yoshiyahu, and people then sit and wait and see, well, how are you going to connect this to the Parsha? Okay? And so what we start off is Tehillim, Amarti laholalim al taholalu. And what we have here is a translation. I say unto the arrogant, deal not arrogantly. The word holalim, what is that? What do you hear in the word? Besides, I'm telling you a translation. But if I, Amar laholalim, what word, what root do you pick out there? Hallel or hallelujah, which would be praise, right? But that's clearly not what's happening
halal
here.
Halal.
Halal to desecrate, okay, maybe. So there are various words that come up in the dictionary. It seems those, you know, the Sansino talks about those who create confusion as opposed to the arrogant. And Michael Sokolov talks about one who creates destruction. So it's interesting. We have arrogance. Now, arrogant people can certainly bring destruction or create confusion. But there's the idea of arrogance or those who bring destruction or those who confuse. And we say to them, don't. Let's see why. Don't. So let's see how this verse is going to play out. Laholalim means to those who create confusion, those whose hearts are full of evil intrigues. This is already the Midrash interpreting the verse in Tehillim. Rabbi Levi used to call them woe makers because they bring woe unto the world. Okay, so those are really two different ideas encapsulated by this word holalim. Halal seems to be something that's being played with there as well. And to the wicked, lift not up the horn. Okay, now let's see where we're going to go with this very interesting verse. And who's wicked and who's righteous? And now we're going to go into a, that's the opening statement. And now we're going to, now this is a fairly pessimistic worldview. The Holy One, blessed be He, said to the wicked, the righteous were never happy in this world of mine, and you seek to be happy. What do you think the Midrash is saying? By the way, lifting up the horn is obviously a sign of triumph, rejoicing, right? We blow the horn when we win a battle, you know, or merrymaking horns. The idea is you tell the wicked, don't be too happy. What do you think God is saying to the wicked?
That sounds like He's saying, the righteous are not happy in this world, but implicitly they'll be happy in this.
Okay, so that seems to be the idea. The righteous were never happy in this world, and you, the wicked, seek to be happy, meaning how dare you blow your horn in triumph? The world is filled with unhappiness and suffering, and the righteous are aware of this. They're not happy in this world, and you seek to be happy. So again, some sort of rebuke. But yes, the world to come seems to be possibly hovering in the background. Adam was never happy in this world of mine, and you seek to be happy. Now the Midrash is going to take a series of biblical figures who suffered and were unhappy. We're going to see who they are. Very interesting selection of choice. Reish Lakish, in the name of Rabbi Shimon, the son of Menasseh, said, the apple of Adam's heel outshone the globe of the sun. How much more so the brightness of his face? First of all, we need to know who Adam is. What does this remind us of? By the way, the apple on the orb of his of Adam's heel. Who does that remind us of? You're going to get this. Whose heel is highlighted in Greek mythology?
Achilles.
Okay, so there seems to be some... It's not coincidental that they choose the heel of Adam. The apple of Adam's heel outshone the globe of the sun. How much more so the brightness of his face? Adam's heel was not his weakness, and his face certainly, wow. Nor need you wonder, in the ordinary way, if a person makes serving trays, one for himself and one for his household, whose will he make more beautiful? Not his own? Similarly, Adam was created for the service of the Holy One, blessed be he, and the globe of the sun for the service of mankind. First of all, what is this setting out? What is the Midrashic author initially setting out? What does it state about the description of man's creation?
Man was created to serve God.
Man is created to serve God, and as a result, what is man?
Happy.
Adam, well, certainly he should be happy. We're not up to happiness. He's a kind of superhuman. He glows with a great light. Even his face outshines the sun, right? We're meant to understand the greatness of the creation that was Adam, the luminous beauty of man, the original man, the first man to be created, because he was created to serve the Holy One, blessed be he. And the sun was only created for mankind. Man was created for God. I've talked about this in a lot of my classes on Midrash. Man was created. The Midrash really threshes over this idea that man was created because God desired man. And you see a little bit of that here. Man was created to serve God. God needed man in his service. Rabbi Levi said, in the name of Rabbi Chama, the son of Hanina, the Holy One, blessed be he, fitted up for him 13 canopies in the Garden of Eden. As it says, you were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering. The cornelian, the topaz, the emerald, the beryl, the onyx, the jasper, the sapphire, the carbuncle, the smaragd, and gold. I've looked up some of these at different times. Very beautiful jewels. The workmanship of your settings and of your sockets was in you. The day that you were created, they were prepared. Again, the Midrash here takes a verse from Yechezkel describing what it was like in the Garden of Eden. What do we already know, of course? What do we know as readers?
Adam sinned in the Garden.
Adam sinned. By the way, sin is not going to be mentioned here. Very interesting. Sin is not going to be mentioned throughout this midrash. Meaning, what would the obvious midrashic or rabbinic idea be? You sinned and you got punished, and that's why you weren't happy in this world. Sin is deliberately left out of this midrash. Fault is left out of this midrash. That is not the reason why he is unhappy. We're going to find out in a moment why he's unhappy.
But that, is that a deliberate? Because we had, by chance, we happened to have studied this about two weeks ago,
and what
there
say?
Were 12 different interpretations of what their sins were and why they were being punished, as opposed to saying it was unjust that they were correctly punished.
Unjust that they were correct. But the beginning is definitely that it was unjust they were correctly punished.
Sorry. Not that it was unjust, that they sinned and therefore they were punished. It's just like when you're talking about the destruction of the Second Temple, the automatic thing that comes to mind is Sinat Chinam. Right off the bat, they're looking at not worthy, just punish, but what did they do that was wrong?
Right. But that's not the question. We're not asking that.
No,
yet.
But that's one thing. It's interesting that they're taking a completely different take on this.
Yes. There are other midrashim that will deal with this. But this midrash, which is among the opening ones on the death of the sons of Nadav and Avihu, is not. Let's wait. And if another teacher has taught some of these midrashim, I'd love to hear what their interpretations are. Okay. 13, 113, numbers are always very important. The 13 midot, the 13 attributes of God, right? So there were 13 canopies. Reish Lakish says there were 11 canopies. The rabbis say there were 10 canopies. 10 would be the Aseret HaDibrot. 11, I'm blanking on what 11 could be, but also some sort of symbolism. And they are not in disagreement. Okay, we'll skip down. And after all this glory, he is told, for dust you are, and unto dust you shall you return. What is this midrash saying about the human condition? It's very interesting. What is man born into? What knowledge?
That he's going to die.
Knowledge that he's going to die. Now, again, notice that sin is not mentioned, meaning we tend to, certainly the Christian idea and the book of Bereshit also, the early stories, man sins and death is brought into the world as a result of sin. Right? That's completely absent here. We know that because we know the Tanakh. But if you didn't know the early stories of creation, you would think life and death came together into the world, And the reason man cannot be truly happy is because of his awareness of death. And there is something to that. I mean, this fear of death that everyone encounters when a child discovers suddenly a beloved pet dies, or a grandparent, hopefully someone old, they begin to recognize their time in the world is finite. It's often when children begin waking up at night. They don't want their parents to leave, right? This fear, something's going to happen. Man lives with this fragility. And so it's very, so he can never be truly happy. That's what this first midrash is saying. Again, notice sin is completely out, not about sin. Now we'll get to Abraham. Abraham went a distance of 3 days' journey. Now the midrash is going to do something also that I find fascinating. After 3 days, her perceived a cloud resting on the top of the mountain. Said he to Yitzhak, "My son, do you see what I see?" "Yes," he answered him. "What do you see?" he inquired. He told him to see a cloud resting on the top of the mountain. He said to Yishmael and Eliezer, total midrashic constructs, of course, this is not a new text. "Do you see anything?" "No," they answered him. Said he to them, "Since you perceive nothing, and this donkey perceives nothing, abide you here with the donkey," with the ass, right? You're basically like the donkey. Okay, so this is, again, classic pitting the good guys against the bad guys, Eliezer and Yishmael versus Yitzhak. Again, by the expression im hachamor, he implied they were a people am hachamor. Okay, a nice little moment, if you will, we can laugh at perhaps 2,000 years later. He took Yitzhak his son and led him up mountains and down hills. He took him up on one of the mountains, built an altar, arranged the wood, prepared the altar pile, and took the knife to slay him. Had not an angel from heaven called him, Isaac would have already been slain. There is proof that this is so, for Isaac returned to his mother. And she said to him, "Where have you been, my son?" Said he to her, "My father took me and led me up mountains and down hills." "Alas," she said, "for the son of a hapless woman. Had it not been for the angel, you would by now have been slain." "Yes," he said to her. Thereupon she uttered 6 cries corresponding to the 6 blasts. It has been said she had scarcely finished speaking when she died. Now I'll just say Sarah is not the example of someone, a righteous person who's not happy in this world, but she's the one who innocently dies, meaning she's the byproduct of the Akedah in this midrash. Notice the 6 cries, the 6 blasts, that brings us back to the horn. There are horns that are in happiness and horns that are in sorrow. This is a sorrowful horn, a horn of mourning. Hence it is written, "And Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her." Where did he come from? He came from Mount Moriah. Any thoughts? What's happening here?
Which is, first, there's proof that this is so. The proof is what they made up themselves.
Right. There is proof that this happened, because let me bring you a midrashic filling in of the gap. It's a midrashic deduction, because Sarah's death comes immediately after the story of the Akedah. It's a filling in the gap. But this certainly fits in well with the idea of the righteous suffering. The midrash does not explicitly list Sarah, but implicitly she's one of the people who suffered, right? She did not know happiness in this world. The brief happiness she knew after the birth of Yitzhak is tempered and, in fact, overturned by her suddenly confrontation of theodicy, of seeing what could have happened had, you know, the angel not stayed her husband's hand. Now, Abraham's response to this is very interesting. Abraham harbored doubts in his heart and thought, "Perhaps, heaven forfend, some disqualifying blemish has been found in him, and his offering has not been accepted." What is this telling us about someone righteous like Abraham in terms of the suffering and, what is this saying? What does Abraham expect to do in the world if he's truly righteous?
Following precisely the word of God.
Okay, to sacrifice. I think Aviva's right. What he's saying is, what do you mean? Suffering is a sign of my commitment to God, my offering up my child. You took that away from me, God. Is there a blemish? Is there a blemish in my devotion? Is there a blemish in my son? Right? It's astonishingly insightful. The Eish Kodesh actually said, David Bernstein brought the Eish Kodesh this morning, that he said a little suffering is a good thing, right? It forces us to perhaps be thankful for the good in our lives. It forces us to go inward and think about our commitment to God. A lot of suffering is not a good thing. He basically says at some point, it's enough, God. Enough already. A little suffering would have been okay. But a lot of suffering is not okay. But it's interesting that Abraham, the righteous, expects to some degree to sacrifice his son, and God has to comfort him. So that's an interesting theological thought, that they're they're critiquing. A heavenly voice went forth and said to him, go your way, eat your bread with joy, for God has already accepted your works. Now again, we were told Abraham did not really experience happiness in this world. Notice the about face when we bring a verse from Kohelet that says, go eat your bread with joy, go be happy, right? So this is an example of where the Midrash doesn't have to be uniform. On one end, it's bringing us examples of the suffering of the righteous or the righteous who aren't happy in this world. On the other hand, just at the moment where Abraham says, why aren't I suffering, God? Oh, go be happy. Now you should be happy. I spared you. Israel did not enjoy B'nai Israel in this world of mine, as may be inferred from the fact it does not say Israel rejoiced in his maker, but shall rejoice. Again, noticing that in Tehillim, the language is in the future tense. Okay, Yismach. As much as to say they are destined to rejoice in the works of the Holy One, blessed be he, in the time to come. Here we have the time to come. The Holy One, blessed be he, if the expression be permitted, now this is, again, fascinating, did not enjoy happiness in this world. God himself is not happy in this world. As may be inferred from the fact that it does not say the Lord rejoiced in his works, the Lord Yismach, also again this idea of Yismach. The Holy One, blessed be he, will in the time to come rejoice in the works of the righteous. In other words, subtext, God doesn't rejoice when we suffer either. That doesn't make God happy. And because we suffer, God is not truly happy till the world to come. Fascinating. And it doesn't end there. That's what's interesting. I mean, it could have ended right there with the Holy One, blessed be he. That certainly would have been an appropriate idea that God suffers with us to some extent. That God cannot truly be happy because his righteous aren't truly happy. Why? Because death exists in this world. Because suffering exists in this world. There's Sarah who drops dead of some sort of heart attack in the wake of discovering the nature of that, of what was almost demanded of her husband and her son. That is not fair. And God can't be truly happy if things like that happen, even though it's God's world. Presumably God can run the world the way he wants. And so it's interesting. And then we go to the last piece. Elisheva, the daughter of Aminadab, did not enjoy happiness in the world. They don't end with God. And I think that's very interesting because God is almost besides the point. True, she witnessed 5 crowns attained by her relatives in one day. Her brother-in-law was king, Moshe. Her brother was a prince, Nachshon ben Aminadab. Her husband was high priest. Her 2 sons were deputy high priests. Her grandson Pinchas was a priest anointed for war. But when her sons entered to offer incense and were burnt, her joy was changed to mourning. Thus it is written, after the death of the 2 sons of Aaron. The Midrash doesn't leave us with God and his suffering. Because you know what? God may suffer, and that's, you know, very nice in theory. But in practice, Elisheva is where we're at. That in one day, true happiness turns to true mourning. Meaning this, the epitome of happiness is Elisheva on the 8th day, where she is queen for the day. Her husband, her brother-in-law, her brother, her sons have all reached the highest roles of leadership and faith and commitment to God. And in one moment, it's all gone. And that's real. And that's what we have to contend with. And so it ends with, after the death of the 2 sons of Aaron. That's what brings us back. Meaning this idea, we actually don't go back to the verse in Tehillim. We end with the verse from the Parsha, which is what we're meant to do. We're meant to end. This idea of to the wicked, or to those who have doubt or confusion or bring confusion into the world, this is what the world is really about. This is the confusion of the world. Don't be overly arrogant. Don't rejoice too much. This is the real stuff. It's very heavy, but it's very real. Very appropriate for this day and for Yom HaZikaron, which is coming up, where we really question these kind of things. And they don't give answers. They could. They will. As the Midrash progresses, they're going to go to sin. There will be. And then they'll pull us back from sin. They're not going to, the final word is not going to be, oh, we all sin, and as a result, this is what happens. It's going to remain with Tzadik V'Rava. Any questions or comments before we move on to the next Midrash? Rabbi Abba ben Kahana opened his discourse by citing, I said of laughter, it is mingled. So here, let me just again, I wrote the pasuk down because I was saving on paper. That was the overall idea. L'schok amarti muhulau. We have this idea. It's from Kohelet 2:2. I said of laughter, it is mingled. What do you think Kohelet is saying? And what does that mean? I said of laughter, it is mingled. Mingled with what? with sadness, right? There's never true laughter because we're always aware of something that mingles, that dilutes the sadness. If the laughter is mixed, of what benefit is the rejoicing? If all of my laughter is tinged with sadness, then what benefit is rejoicing? And this is where I'll say this midrash does a wonderful masterful job, of alluding to the story with Nadav and Avihu, and particularly that last piece, Hayitav be'inei Adonai v'yitav be'inav. So I want you to keep that in mind. A story is told of one of the dignitaries of Kabul who gave his son away in marriage. On the fourth day, he invited guests to his house. When they had eaten and drunk, now remember the fourth day is parallel to the eighth day, right? It's half, fourth and eighth. Made their hearts merry, he said to his son, "Go up and bring a barrel from the upper chamber." When he went up, a serpent bit him, and he died. Okay, now again, there's wine here, and drinking, and happiness, and merriness. He, the father, waited for him to come down. And as he did not come down, he said, "I will go up and see Hametivin Bini. I don't have the midrash in front of me, but he uses this language of what Hametivin Bini, what's going on with my son? Again, that language of Tov that I think is a deliberate connection to our story. He went up and found that he had been bitten by a serpent and was dead, lying among the barrels. So this gives us even, it's a little Moshe Simon, Shushan Simon, who has a wonderful course on reading Midrash Agadah, writes, it's a little Hitchcockian. We already know the son has died. We have the father going down to, going up, actually, to see what happened. And now we have yet another detail. He's lying kind of splayed among the barrels, meaning it's even more visual than we had pictured. And he waited until the guests had finished their meal and said to them, "My masters, not to bless my son with the bridegroom's blessing have you come, but pronounce over him rather the mourner's blessing." He waits until the meal is finished. Again, it's somewhat of an inverse. He allows them to finish their meal because they don't have the knowledge. Presumably, he does not partake of the meal, right? Aaron and his two sons, Itamar and Eleazar, are not going to partake of a meal. They know Nadav and Avihu have died. At this point, only he knows, and he allows them to finish their meal. And I want to ask you if you think that was the right thing to do, meaning it's complicated. They're his guests. They're there to celebrate. He allows them to finish the festive meal as if they're still celebrating. They don't notice the bridegroom has gone missing. Only the father notices, which again makes a lot of sense, right? Remember, there's wine, there's merriment, there's revelry. The bride and the groom almost get lost in the fray of the dancing, the singing, the eating. "Have you not come to bring my son under the bridal canopy? Come, carry him to his grave." Rabbi Zakkai of Kabul concluded, "I said of laughter, this." Okay, and so these are very heavy, very intense. They're offering no comfort. There's no consolation here. There is the father who recognizes this is the human condition. We rejoiced with my son, and now we're burying my son. This is what we do. And so, again, real tragedy, and real tragedy in the wake of true happiness, right? So the laughter is mingled. We always have this awareness. Okay, now we're going to move to a slightly different voice. So these are the opening. There were four midrashim, 1 to 4, that are very similar. They do not attempt to condemn God, but they don't attempt to condemn the human condition, the humans who suffer, meaning it's more questions without any sort of answers. This is the human condition. This is what we live with, which is why the righteous are never happy. It's true, many people may go through their lives unaware of the fragility of the boundaries between life and death, but all we need to do is look around and we understand, and so our laughter is always mingled. Okay, let's see where this is going to take us to. There'll be maybe a little humor. Now I have these sources again. Now I'll read them in their original. Ravacha Rav Zera Patach. Now again, a verse from Eov. We already. Af lezot yecharad libi v'yitarim kormal. At this also my heart trembles. Vayitar out of its place. Now what does vayitar mean? It leaped. This idea of the heart leaping out of its chest. It's a very visceral image. Again, if a heart leaps out of a chest, you'll die. Right, you know, the heart leaping out of the chest is not a good image. It suggests, again, tremendous fear, trembling, anticipation. Mahu vayiter vayikvotz Kamanda Amar, Lenatzer Bahen Ala Eretz, wherewith to leap upon the earth. Okay, now we come to a really interesting midrash. Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu, and now God is speaking. Lo yiyu banav shel Aaron domin l'mateyu shenichnas yavesh v'yatza lach. Shall the sons of Aaron not even be like his rod, which entered dry and came out full of sap? Again, in a few chapters, we're going to have the proof that Aaron is the chosen one. His rod will burst into bloom. So the rod manages to go from something dead and dry to something animate and alive. Shouldn't the sons of Aaron who went in alive come out alive? And now the Midrash brings Titus. Titus harasha nechnas levei kodshei hakodashim. He went into the interior of the Holy of Holies with his sword drawn. V'charvo shlufo biyado gider taparochet v'yatzat charvo le'adam. Nechnas b'shalom v'yatzat b'shalom. Basically, you'll notice where the critique is in a moment. Titus, the wicked Titus, the arrogant we talked about, the arrogant wicked who think there's rejoicing in this world. He cuts into the curtain, his sword comes out full of blood, even though presumably the interior is empty, right? But it doesn't matter, there's blood everywhere. He enters in peace and departs in peace. And what did the sons of Aaron do? They went in to offer incense. They went in to serve God, and they came out burnt. And then it says, so where's the critique here? Who's leveling the critique at whom?
At God.
God, and God at himself. Right? Not only is the Midrash critiquing God, but God himself is critiquing God by saying, how did this happen? How did the sons of Aaron enter full of life and come out dead? And the wicked Titus entered alive and went out, meaning, hafuch al hafuch, as they say. So you have, again, theodicy, absolutely. But even God questioning theodicy, which is, again, there are no answers here. There is only this unbelievable parallel between Titus, the wicked Titus, who destroys and kills and ransacks the temple and God's people and emerges in peace, and the holy sheep, if you will, the holy priests who go to offer and come out burnt. And there's no critique of Nadav and Abihu here whatsoever. I mean, again, I already said in the first four, it was more universal. We weren't really talking about Nadav and Abihu. Their story is the paradigm of universal mingling of laughter. But here we have a real critique of God because these were holy people. Okay.
It's interesting, the notion of God critiquing himself, because
yes,
at least the text says, Teisei esh milifnei Hashem. God actually caused this.
Yes, of course. So it's in first person God, and then it goes into third person. But is this God? Right, of course God caused it.
Right.
But it's God almost now removed and saying, wait a minute, how did this happen?
Did I do the right thing?
Right, how did I? And then I let teach it, meaning it's God stepping back and saying, wait a minute, I treated them worse than I treated the rod of Aaron, let alone Titus. Right? And so this idea of first person and then moving into third person, the Yetzus Rufim, right, they came out burnt, as if God's looking and saying, wait a minute.
How did this happen?
And again, that's it. The Midrash leaves us with this tremendous questioning from within God himself, using God's voice, without any answers. And now, okay, it goes on again. I've now skipped to 9. Now we're moving to the idea that they sinned. Okay? So we first started with this idea that, the righteous do not rejoice in this world. The righteous are never happy, and you seek to be happy. Laughter is mingled, kind of the universal human condition. And God himself is part of it. God himself is part of the universal condition, because God is never truly happy. Right? God presumably also suffers with us. God creates the situation. Then we have God questioning theodicy, which is from God. And now we're getting to some very interesting suggestions, what they did. So this is also very human, and I'll say people like to find blame. In the wake of the Holocaust, terrible statements, it's hard to understand them, from kind of ultra-Orthodox rabbis, that it was because of the secular Jews, the Zionists, right? People trying to find some sort of reason. Sinat Chinam is the Second Temple. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about that is, 2,000 years later, we kind of accept that. Oh, yeah, well, they hated one another, and I guess there was due cause. Meaning, it becomes the reason the Second Temple is destroyed. But if we're able for a minute to think about what that looked like, that kind of wholesale slaughter, destruction, burning, and so on, and recognize that it was a Holocaust, we wouldn't be perhaps so quick to say, well, the second temple was destroyed because of the first temple because they worshipped idols, the second temple because of Sina Chinam. That meant men, women, children, many of whom were innocent, were being slaughtered because some people hated one another. Meaning, you know, but 2,000 years later, we kind of package it. We package it. We can't package the Holocaust yet, but some people, and hopefully we never will, but I think there was an attempt in the wake of the Holocaust to try to figure out why God would do this. There must be some reason. There must have been some sort of blatant evil or wickedness among the people, and this was corrective. Others will say it was to pave the door for the state of Israel, which, again, people trying to find reasons, to find good within the bad.
Isn't that an enormous chutzpah?
Absolutely. But the Midrash is going to try now to do the same thing to Nadav and Abihu because we want to feel God has some sort of rational reason for what he does. Instead of saying, we don't understand God, his ways are unknowing, it makes no sense, God just, you know, it defies any understanding. Many responded with silence. Right? I think Rosh Soloveitchik responded with silence for quite a long time, if I'm not mistaken. But at a certain point, I think he did in Kol Dodi Dofek begin to respond to it. Rav Mani of Shabav, Rav Yitzchak Yoshua of Sichnin, and Rav Yochanan in the name of Levi said, the sons of Aaron died for four things, in connection with each of which death is mentioned. Okay, so this is trying to package, trying to spin it. Well, they must have died for a reason. They had drunk wine, and in connection with this death is mentioned. This is a very famous idea in the Midrash, because immediately after the death, a few verses later, God says to Aaron, drink no wine nor strong drink, that you die not. Well, they must have been drunk. That's one possibility, one pack. But notice they don't give one. There's no uniformity here either. They don't really know. This is another attempt to grapple with the suffering of the righteous, the death of good people. Well, they weren't really good people. Or they sinned. And when you sin, there's a price to pay. Never mind the fact that Titus manages to, kill and destroy, and he walks away. Because while officiating, they lacked the prescribed number of garments. Wow. And in connection with this, death is mentioned. And we see in Exodus 28:43, they shall be upon Aaron and upon his sons, that they bear no iniquity and die. In other words, what this Midrash does is look for the places in which the sons of Aaron and Aaron are warned, you need to follow this protocol or you will die. Does that mean immediate death? Does that mean eventual death? Does that mean take this really seriously because you will die? But what did they lack? The robe, in connection with which death is mentioned. As it says, and it shall be upon Aaron to minister that he die not, because they entered the sanctuary without washing hands and feet, for it says, so they shall wash their hands and their feet that they die not. Again, they go to all the different verses in which there was a warning, and they say, look, they must have transgressed one of these. And then it makes some sense. They were warned. If you're warned and you do something and you're told you'll die if you do it, so they die. That's what happens. When they go into the tent of meeting, they shall wash with water that they die not. Because they had no children. Now, this is the most interesting. Those three actually have a warning associated with them. So this idea that maybe they transgressed, it's a little bit like when you walk by the electric poles. And there are not only words that say, do not climb on pain of death. There are pictures, right, in case you can't read, of someone falling off the pole, right? And you decide, what the heck? Someone dared me. I'm going to climb off the electric pole. We might feel very bad. In fact, we might feel terrible, especially if it's a young person who was doing something stupid. But ultimately, there's reason. You were warned. You didn't follow the warning. And you died. Right, all sorts of dangerous areas that you're told don't go in. Unfortunately, on Pesach, Chol HaMoed, three young men who died because they went into the Kinneret, and there were warnings, do not go into the Kinneret, meaning people often feel, now what's the big deal? It's water, what could happen? It's the Kinneret. You see it on the beach all the time, also in the ocean. I'm not, obviously, God forbid, in any way, sanguine about it. But I will say that it's a message, it's a lesson. When we're told things are dangerous, in fact, they are often dangerous, and people pay with their lives for not being careful. Okay. So three times we're told with drinking, with the robe, and with the washing of the hands and feet, they're warned that if you behave in this manner, you will die.
Although the warning for the drinking comes afterwards.
Yes, of course. The others came before. It's conflating, absolutely. Then they come to this idea, if we would open Numbers 3:4, Nadab and Abihu died again, the third time. It's very interesting. The third time we're told about their death. Once is when they die, once is chapter 16. And once is when it goes through the genealogy and it looks at the line of Aaron and Moses, it tells us again, but Nadab and Abihu died by the will of the Lord when they offered alien fire before the Lord in the wilderness of Sinai, and they left no sons. So this is a much more elusive connection. This idea, because they had no children, they were worthy of death. That's already... Yes.
It's not mistaken, one of the Midrashim says that Ben-Zomar, who ended Pardes, was killed
yes.
because of this.
Yes, yes, yes. Ben-Azai deliberately has no children. I see that. Okay. So, and then Abba Chanin adds one more sin because they had no wives. For it is written, he shall make atonement for himself and for his house. That's what Aaron is told how to behave on Yom Kippur. And his house signifies his wife. What just happened? By the way, five voices, five different suggestions. It tells us, by the way, four. They like four in the Midrash. But then they add one in. They also like that. Five cups of the five languages of redemption, right? Really four, and we add one. So this is also a known kind of device. We'll mention four, because four is a very powerful number. But then, by the way, there's really five. So we'll stick one in at the end. Okay. Three, at least, are biblically documented. Two are a little bit far-fetched and come from the imagination of the people in the Beit Midrash. What's happening? What do you think is happening there?
They're searching for reasons.
Searching for reasons. Yeah. Searching for reasons. And this idea, what is the marriage and children coming? What is that doing? Very interesting. Think about the time frame. This is between 400 and 500 CE. What do you think it's coming out against?
Celibacy, and
this idea of priests being monastic, priests being celibate, mm-hmm. this idea that they thought that was what the priesthood should be. They were overly holy. So again, here we have not transgression, but too much holiness, which again is very, very interesting conceptually. This idea that they chose to separate themselves from sexuality, from procreation, because they were priests. That's beginning to infiltrate, and I'm sorry, this got cut off. I don't know how. There's a midrash I'm going to read to you. This I find to be a little bit humorous.
So this was about exactly the same time as the church decreed that celibacy was the way to go.
No question. Yeah, this is more or less
fifth,
overlapping. It's a little late. Yes. Yes.
Around then.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. 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 I think this is, I actually was at an engagement party on Friday, and the Rav got up to speak, someone from Ranana, and he brought this midrash, and he basically said that this was their mistake, that marriage is what Judaism believes in. Even the priests need to be married. We all need to be married. We find that is the uniqueness, if you will, of Judaism's aspiration towards spirituality and godliness. It's through intimacy and sexuality and procreation and so on. So he used this midrash. Now, I'm just going to read you. This I find amusing in light of the human condition to their dating. And Jonah, you're engaged, married?
Engaged.
Rabbi Levy, I apologize. This is 2010. I'm skipping to 2010, and you don't have it on your sheet, so I'll ask you to just listen patiently. I know it's hard to do that when we are used to texts in front of us. Rabbi Levy says they were arrogant. Many women remained unmarried waiting for them. Now, I don't know. Now, I love this, because I was single once, and you were single not that long ago. And there are always the guys that you want to date that won't go out with you. And usually, and let's be honest, they're usually very good-looking, very educated, often very religious, like the creme de, you know, they're the ones everyone wants to go out with, and you send out a notice on, today would be on Twitter, Facebook, JDate, whatever. And they're very often, not all, I don't want to condemn all, you know, men, and certainly not all good-looking men, but there's a tipus, as they say, that know that they are worthy, and as a result, sometimes wait years to get married. Many of them hopefully get married, but sometimes it takes years, and many women remain unmarried. I know women who remained unmarried waiting for some of these men to make up their minds. They dated them, they broke up with them, they waited years. In two cases, I know of happy endings. 12 years later. Okay. So imagine they were almost 40, and these women could not move on. There's something painful there. What did they say? So here's the Midrash written by men, understanding the problem that men pose. Men like Nadav and Avihu, or men like these the prototype I kind of very superficially threw out, present to women, because women wait a minute, I want to marry Nadav and Avihu. What did they say? Our father's brother is a king. Our mother's brother is a prince. Notice, by the way, this is the inverse of the Elisheva, right? Very clever. Our father is a high priest, and we are both deputy high priests. What woman is worthy of us? So this is very different than the chosen celibacy that the Midrash we just read suggests. That they felt they were too... They didn't want... I mean, Ben Azai basically says, I know I should marry and have children. What can I do? My heart yearns for Torah. I love Torah. I'm in love with the Torah. I can't get married. That's what the previous Midrash seems to be suggesting. Women, wives, and children will distract us from serving God, and that was a problem. Here, it's very different. They're arrogant because of, you know, Elisheva, you know, the description we saw earlier in the Midrash, that, you know, that kind of idea that we come from this very holy stock, this very, and so on. And then the Midrash goes on, Rav Menachma, in the name of Rabbi Yoshua ben Nechemia, quoted, fire devoured their young men. Why had fire devoured their young men? This is from Tehillim. Because the virgins had no marriage song. So again, also from Psalms. Both of those are plays on texts and Psalms. This idea the virgins had no marriage song because they were waiting for these young men, and the fire ended up devouring the young men. And again, fire is definitely a play on passion, sexual passion. It's extinguished by God because they weren't directing it in the manner they should, and so on. Okay. So that's another idea in the Midrash, one that I think is astonishingly insightful in terms of understanding both men and women in the dating world. Okay. Now we'll look at the last one, and then we'll more or less wrap it up. Rav Abba Bar Avina inquired, Mimnei ma nismacha parshat mitat Miriam le'efer para. So now they're moving to the death of Miriam. So the first section really brought up this idea of laughter is mingled, and the fact that the word Hallel and Hololim are very tightly connected, that there's never Hallel without Hololim, that there's confusion or despair within the rejoicing. Then we came to a question of theodicy, that God himself questioned theodicy. Then we went through a section somewhere from 6 or 7 until 11 of blaming them for improper behavior, either defying actual commandments, what they were commanded to do in the Torah, or something more more general defying, if you will, the world order of what righteous people are supposed to do, marriage, children. We brought in arrogance. I didn't bring the Midrashim that talk about the arrogance that they defied Moshe, this idea of defying your rabbinic authority by bringing your own law. Okay, all of that appears in this section. And it ends with 12. It ends with this one. I think there were 12. And I think it's very important that it ends. Again, the editor has clearly taken us on a journey. They take a look at another story, that the death of Miriam is in close proximity to that dealing with the ashes of the Para Aduma. Simply to teach this, that as the ashes of the heifer affect atonement, kach mitata tzadikim mechaperet. Now, they're going to try to bring some comfort here. I'm not suggesting we will all find comfort. Again, it's trying to find something that at least this is the Holocaust led to the state of Israel idea. That when the righteous die for no reason, suddenly, before we want them to, nonetheless, it does something up in the world to come that helps those of us down here. So the Para Aduma achieves physical atonement, right? If you want to go from being impure with death impurity to pure, you need to go through the ashes of the Para Aduma. And what it suggests is virtually, in the other world, in the spiritual world, the death of the righteous is doing something similar, sprinkling the ashes, if you will, the virtual ashes over all of us. And now it's going to go in that direction. Amar Rav Yudin. Why is the death of Aaron recorded in close proximity to the breaking of the tablets in the recap? Elamalame Chaya Kashel Baruch Hu Mitato Shel Aaron Kishvirat Luchot. Aaron's death was as grievous to God as the breaking of the tablets. And now again, we're moving closer to the idea that God mourns when the righteous die. Even Aaron, he's not a young man. It doesn't matter. You remove someone whose whole life was serving God, and that is as difficult to Aaron as the actual God as the breaking of the tablets.
Yes. This is in Devarim, I presume.
Devarim, of course. No, it's in Bamidbar. It's the end of Bamidbar. Of course, Bamidbar. Because Aaron dies soon after.
But the breaking of the tablets.
There's a recap. Yeah. Oh, you mean in the recap? Yes. It's
yeah,
in the
recap.
Yeah, it has to be. It doesn't bring the. Hold on a second. Yeah, it didn't bring the source citation. I'll have to look it up. Amar Rav Chiya bar Abba, Ba'alef b'Nisan, Metu banav shel Aaron. The sons of Aaron died on the first of Nisan. V'lama maskir mitatan b'yom ha-kippurin. Why then is their death mentioned in connection with the Day of Atonement? They died on the first of Nisan. Why in Achrei Mot, and we read it on Yom Kippur, are we reminded of their death, which is in connection to Yom Kippur? We're back to the idea that Nadav and Abihu were really righteous. And they died because that's what happens. Righteous people die for no good reason that we can see. Again, theodicy. And you know what? The only comfort we can take in it is that it achieves some sort of atonement that we can't understand or fathom. Nonetheless, this is where they're trying to move to something like comfort. Wait a minute. How do I know that Yom HaKippurim atones? Well, it says, on this day, atonement shall be made to cleanse you. How do I know the death of the righteous affects atonement? And this is, again, it's interesting to go to this idea. They buried the bones of Saul and Yonatan, his son, and after that, God was entreated. Okay, and so again, this idea that Saul and Yonatan die, righteous people, okay, problematic stories there, but I'm not going into that. Conceptually, the king of Israel and his son die in such a unlawful, such a terrible manner. And God is only entreated. When does God become entreated for the land? When they're buried properly. So some sort of atonement. Again, perhaps some sort of plug for burying our dead properly. But that's the end. And so this idea that the death of the righteous somehow affects atonement, we're supposed to get that from the juxtaposition of God being entreated when the bones of Saul and Yonatan are buried. Very elusive again. Why they're bringing in the bones of Saul and Yonatan, I'm not exactly sure. But the idea is, again, to reinforce this idea, the death of the righteous affects atonement, and then the Midrashic author rests, at least for the moment.
Now, isn't that the notion of God grieving as well? Isn't that inconsistent with, and I don't know where this is from, it's in from Hallel, Yakar Beineha Hashem HaMavdala Chazita.
Yes. Yes, yeah. Yes. It's funny that they didn't bring that. That's true. Maybe they bring it somewhere else. And so really we've gone on quite a journey, and I think one that reflects the way we try to make sense. Various ideas are the way we also disconnect. Meaning it's not Yom HaZikaron, that's next week, but I remember when the three young boys were murdered for hitchhiking in Gush Etzion. I live in Gush Etzion. It's a hitchhiking area that my daughters hitchhike from, and they serve in the army. One of them was in the army at the time with a lot of secular Israelis from Tel Aviv and so on. And largely, the response was, "In order, I want to even defend them a little bit. We want to make sense of horror." And one of the things they did to deflect was they shouldn't have been hitchhiking, right? Instead of understanding a brutal murder took place here, and obviously the murderers had the choice to murder or not murder. The response of, well, that won't happen to us, right? That can't happen to us. We would never hitchhike in such a dangerous area, right? People do it all the time. They sinned. They violated the word of God. What can you do? We won't do that. If we serve as priests, we'll make sure to put our robe on and not drink and wash our hands and feet and to get married and have children. We're always looking to protect ourselves, which is why we package the first temple and the second temple the way we do. Well, they worshipped idols. We don't worship idols. Sinat chinam, look at all the chesed that goes on. Look at all the wonderful deeds of goodness that we do for one another, right? We try to distance ourselves by creating some sort of package. It can't happen to us. But you see, the Midrash doesn't allow us to remain in that space. It brings many, many voices. that sometimes there are no words. There's no understanding. There's always in the back of our minds the awareness of the fragility of our lives and the fact that that's why the righteous can never be truly happy. And God himself can never be truly happy in creating us into that condition. Because that first midrash we saw with Adam, God creates us for his own purpose, just like he creates the serving trays and he makes the nicest one, the king makes the nicest one for himself, but yet God is responsible for the course of our lives and the way our lives play out by creating us in such a way. And so all of these ideas get woven somewhat messily, but I think in a very vibrant manner, reflecting kind of the active discourse in the Beit Midrash around, we are hearing the voices as they sit down and wrestle with the same things we wrestle with today. And it's obviously deliberate that the last voice is meant, as weak as it seems, to give us some sort of comfort. And perhaps I'm not being fair, maybe because I read this and I think, well, that doesn't sound very comforting. But I think there are people who truly, again, I have friends, unfortunately, whose children have been killed in terror incidences and family members. And I remember the summer, again, the three boys were murdered, this idea that, well, we then discovered the tunnels.
Yeah.
Right? This idea, wait, their murder led to the discovering of the tunnels. And I will say there was something comforting about that to the families. I don't know how comforting. I can't pretend to or have the bombacity. But this idea that, well, something came out of it. So people do want to feel that there was some meaning to the haphazard death or suffering. And so that I think that's where 12 takes us. This idea there is something that happens nonetheless after in ways we can't understand to achieve atonement and comfort. Yes?
This is all very different from this kind of notion of hashgacha pratit, that yes. God is kind of responsible for everything, every jot and tittle of our
yes.
existence.
Yes, yes, yes. It's not going there. It doesn't go there at all.
It doesn't go there at all.
Right. The only 5 brings this idea that God questions his own theodicy. But that's about it, meaning this idea. And so I think these are ideas that are worth thinking about. And I think, you know, ideas that we can... I think the comfort I take in this is that they don't try to give us answers. That ultimately they leave the conversation open. They invite many, many, many voices into the conversation. And they push the conversation forward. You know, by writing it down, by allowing us to engage in it and to reflect and to continue to ask those questions. So thank you very much.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.